Thank you so much, Ray and David. You're just fantastic. Thank you. So much appreciation. I also want to say a word of appreciation for Chris Kimbler, who couldn't be here today. He kind of called in at the last minute. He has a family emergency. He's fine. He should be back next week. But I also, again, another word of appreciation for Ray for jumping into the fray and just taking over. It's just fantastic of you. So thank you for that. Boy, that's one of these things lately, you know? Have you noticed that things are changing? And that it's really hard to keep up with the changes sometimes, you know? yeah. I decided to do things a little bit differently this morning, and part of it is from this this monk that I know. His name is Reverend Heng Shor, and some of you have heard me talk about him before. He's a fairly well-known monk that did this great bowing pilgrimage around, I'm not sure exactly where it was, someplace in the United States, but he would do three steps and a bow, and he did it for about 3 years. And when he was done, it's so funny, when he was done, he went to his master, met the master monk, and he said, you know, I still don't know how to bow. I'm really in this for my ego. I want people to be impressed. I really want people to be impressed that I'm such a good bower. And the monk said, well, here's what you do. You don't do it in public. You just bow around the monastery for another 6 months. So for another 6 months, he did six months of three steps and a bow around the monastery. And then after that, he said, yeah, I'm cured. I'm good. I had to do this. So one of the things Reverend Heng Shor says is that we're supposed to make the choice that's the most difficult on our ego. How about that? Anybody down with that? I'm not all the time. Yeah, kamsa, right? I've always felt a bit prideful that I can speak without notes. I get compliments all the time, particularly from my sister, who's an academic, who reads everything. You know, she presents papers and reads it verbatim, and then everybody rips it apart, kind of like a sermon. But today I had this inspiration that I should probably read you this talk like a story and see how it goes. Because again, we're in a place of reinvention, and I want to try something different. I want to talk a little bit shorter if I can. I'm open to different possibilities, new possibilities for this church, and this just seems to be what Spirit told me to do next. So today I'm going to read you a story written by me. So the title of my message today is Fear Not. And these words may sound familiar to you if you were raised in the Christian tradition or if you're familiar with Handel's Messiah, as many of us are. The shepherds are abiding in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night, and suddenly, bam! That's in Handel's Messiah, by the way. An angel appears, and the shepherds are sore afraid. Because they're afraid, I'm going to assume that they do what I do when I'm afraid, which is stress eating and watching copious amounts of bad television. But wait, the story does not stop with their fear. They don't run helter-skelter towards the television or eat themselves into oblivion. Suddenly, the angel stops them and she says, put down that chocolate chip cookie, put down that jar of peanut butter, put down that remote and listen to what I have to tell you. Fear not, for I bring you glad tidings of great joy. And the angel tells them of the rebirth of the Christ consciousness. That's how we would say it in this spiritual center. It's the rebirth of the Christ consciousness, the refocusing of the Christ consciousness. And so the shepherds, they drop the remote control, they pack up the peanut butter and the chocolate cookies, they strap on their sandals, and they power walk over to Bethlehem to go and kneel at the feet of the Christ. That is exactly what it says in the Bible. Fear not. Richard Rohr says that the most common one-liner in the Bible is, do not be afraid. Someone counted, and it occurs 365 times. I think it's interesting, don't you? Why do you think it's interesting, Brother Ray?
Each day.
Exactly. That's where I was going. If you didn't hear, Ray said you get one for each day, right? Every day you can remind yourself to fear not, to do not be afraid. Rumi, who supplied us with our poem this morning, Rumi writes that every day we wake up empty and frightened. You know, upon hearing these things from the writers of the Bible and from Jalaluddin and Rumi, who is a great sage and a great mystic, it kind of makes me wonder, are the authors of every book in the Bible and Jalaluddin and Rumi reading my diary? Are they? They seem to know things about me. Or maybe they're reading the collective diary that's written on the human race on the blank screen of existence. Metaphorically speaking, probably yes. Because fear is a common condition. Denial of fear is also a common condition. I want to tell you something. The other day, I was walking with someone, and we were having a conversation, and I was mentioning that I am exhausted much of the time. Anybody else? And I said to this person, I don't know why I'm so exhausted. I mean, after all, it's only a global pandemic. And I meant it. I was not being facetious. I was like, who can't cope with a global pandemic? Everybody should be able to cope with a global pandemic. So fear is common. It's a common condition. But it's also very easy to minimize something major, not only for people like me who happen to be running a church, but for all of us who are staggering around in this strange situation with undiagnosed cases of pandemic fatigue, perhaps feeling crushed by a heavy blanket of impermanence and uncertainty. It's easy to be afraid, but it's also easy to deny the fear. And we do that. Particularly if we're spiritual, right? How often do we minimize challenges in the name of faith? I've done that. Have you done that? Right? David Kerrigan clearly has done it. We do it. We minimize something major. And yet, how is that possible? Because at the same time, in this denomination, in many teachings, we always teach that God is bigger. You know that saying, don't tell God how big your problems are, tell your problems how big your God is? Right? Right? So which is it? Are our problems bigger than God, or is God bigger than our problems? Should we minimize our problems and pretend they don't exist? Or should we dive into them with consciousness? I don't know the answer. Is it small? Is it big? Is it major? Is it minor? Probably yes. All of the above. I think the key is, how do we find balance? How do we find balance? How do we move consciously and kindly through these very interesting times? How do we hold our humanity and our divinity, our strength and our frailty, like they're notes in the same glorious chord? You know, like a chord wouldn't be right if all of the notes weren't in there. How do we rewrite the scriptures that say, fear not, into, you know, it's okay to acknowledge your fear, but you don't have to let it swallow you. You don't have to give it so much power. We can work with fear in a constructive way so that it transforms into some kind of a blessing, some kind of a blessing that passes our current human understanding. And we can find that balance. I know we can find that balance. But how? The other day, I read a parable, a Jewish teaching story. And this was in a book that I'm reading that was given to me by Reverend Karen Mondragon. I've been reading it and rereading it over the last couple of years, you know, since, March 2020 or so. And the name of the book is not really this, but I call it How to Lead When You Don't Have a Clue What You're Doing. The book is really called I don't even remember the real name of the book right now, but it's about how to lead when there's lots of questions and when you're in what she refers to as a liminal space, which means a space of waiting. It's kind of like purgatory, you know, where you don't know whether to go this way or that way, and you just have to wait for things to fall in place. You just have to wait. How many of us like to wait for things to fall into place? How many of us? Raise your hand. Stand up so we can worship you if you... Doreen, all righty. Doreen, come on up here. Give the rest of the talk if you would, okay? it was in this book by Susan Beaumont, who's a wonderful coach for churches and ministers and whatnot. And the story goes like this. It's a Jewish teaching story. And she writes that there was once a man who aspired to be a great archer. And he practiced and he practiced, but he still wasn't as good as he wanted to be. He wanted to be the perfect archer. In his quest for perfection, he was asking people, how do I learn how to do this better? And that people told him about this master archer. The people said, this master archer hits bullseyes 100% of the time. 100%. And the man said, wow, I want to be like that. I want some of that. So I want to go on a quest to find this great archer. And the people told him, go into this forest here, and soon you'll start seeing trees with targets and bullseyes on them. And the more trees you see with targets and bullseyes on them, the closer you'll be getting. So the man went into the forest, and first there was nothing, and he wondered if he was going in the right direction. But soon he saw one tree, and it had a target, right? Like the target logo, right? With a bullseye in it, with an arrow smack in the middle of it. And then he saw another, and then he saw another, and then he saw another, and soon there were trees with targets and arrows all over them. And then he came into a clearing, and there was a barn there, and on the side of the barn there was at least 10 targets with arrows right in the middle of them. He said, this must be the place. I have reached my destination. And then the barn door swung open, and a man stood in the light, and the angel said, oh, everybody, oh. Good job, okay. Oh. The man on the quest said, are you the master archer? And the master said, yes, I am. Can we do it again? It's in my notes. Everybody said, oh, good job. Oh, thank you. Thank you for playing with me. Please, the seeker said as he fell on his knees in front of the master archer, please, oh Swami, as I mix Judaism and Hinduism, please, and I'm wearing a Buddha, by the way, please, how do you do it? How can you teach me to be a master like you? And the master replied, it's easy. It's so easy. You have no idea how easy it is to get a perfect bullseye every time. This is what I do. I shoot the arrow into the side of a tree or the side of a barn. And then I come up with a can of paint. And I paint the target around where the arrow has gone. Thank you. All right. It's a Jewish teaching story. Now, I'm not Jewish, but I think that there is a profound metaphor in this. And this is it may not be what the Jewish community says is the metaphor, but this is what the religious science folks would say the metaphor is, okay? I think that in this teaching, in this story, the arrow represents our thoughts, our perception. We shoot an arrow of thought into the universe, and it lands somewhere. And then, based on the thought, based on our perception that we have sent out there, we draw reality around it, right? Am I talking about, yeah, I got it right? Okay then, thank you. Thank you over there, ladies. I appreciate that. You know, we draw reality around it, and instead of seeing what is real, we see what we believe. And this is the most important part. Because we're in the bullseye, we call it bullseye, and we say, we're right. This is reality. Yes, I am in the center of truth because it's the center of what I see, the center of reality, right? And you're not. The thought comes first, and then we build reality around it. So I think the moral of this metaphor is, the teaching of this metaphor is to be mindful of the arrows of perception that we send out, because a seemingly solid reality will form around whatever we perceive. And I think in times like this, you know, we can always choose to send out arrows of fear and construct a target around that and say, you see, I'm right, it's terrifying here. We're sending it out an arrow of fear, and we're drawing that target around it, gathering evidence to prove why we should be so fearful. Or we can send out arrows of faith and love. And if we send out arrows of faith and love, the reality surrounding us will be faith and love. we'll be able to see it. We'll be able to acknowledge it. We'll be able to be it. But how do we do this? Again, how do we do this when right now there seems to be so much evidence for fear and so much evidence against love? Sometimes in facing doubt or fear, I turn to nature, both to point out my own shortcomings and to give me guidance. A couple of weeks ago, I bought this amaryllis bulb. Are you all familiar with amaryllis bulbs? You can get them at the grocery store, and they're these little bulbs, and they have these shoots coming out of them, and they normally grow really fast, and then they make a bright red flower on the top. They're beautiful, and it's often a holiday tradition. So I bought this amaryllis bulb, and I planted it, and I watered it, and I put it on this little altar that I have in my home next to some candles and a little cross that I have and a little Ganesh that I have and a dog collar and a spray bottle to keep the dogs away from it. And then I waited for this mystical being, this amaryllis bulb, to grow. And the little stinker didn't want to budge. The little stinker did not want to budge. So first, I blamed nature, thinking that the bulb was defective. When that didn't cause it to grow, I blamed myself. I am a notorious killer of plants. A serial killer of plants, if you will. So I ferreted around in my busy mind to figure out what I could have done wrong. Too much water, not enough light, not enough loving kindness, not enough care, putting too much pressure on this little plant to show me God. All of these things. And then a still small voice. A voice that is still small, by the way. I wish it were a little bigger at times. A still small voice whispered in my ear and said, "I know. Why don't you try patience?" I said, "I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that term." The voice said, "Have a little faith. Nature knows what she is doing." And so I waited, I watched, and I prayed, not for nature to change, but for me to change my relationship with nature. We don't change reality, we change our position in it. Thank you very much, Ernest Holmes. We don't change reality, we change our position in it. So I had to reorient my position in reality. I had to slow down, trust, fear not, or if I fear, not to give it a lot of power. And then the bulb grew. Without my input, without my effort, it grew. It was sneaky. It grew when I wasn't looking. It grew despite my thought that it wouldn't grow. It grew some more, and now it's about to bloom. In fact, because it's sneaky, it could be blooming right now. A bright red flower, a hope that completely ignored my sea of doubt and fear. Once again, nature triumphed. The message here in this part of this message is that nature will triumph. If things don't seem to be evolving or growing up to speed, whether it's a personal issue or a global pandemic that just doesn't seem to want to quit, or our own relationship with our perceived shortcomings, with our fears or our lack of faith, it's certainly okay to ask, is there something that I could do differently? That's always helpful. And to listen to the answer with kindness and respect and celebration that something great might be coming through us that wants to be expressed. Can I participate in the solution? And there is often something to be done. But it's equally important to wait, to watch and pray, to observe our fear and refrain from giving it too much power, to trust nature, and to move at the speed of nature. Love the process. Love yourself in the process. Allow nature to be nature. Allow God to be God. Ultimately, because all things bend to the arc of greater good, there will be growth, there will be peace, there will be healing. Fear not. Our sacred reading today was a poem about Christianity from a Sufi master, Jalaluddin Rumi. A Sufi master tells us that God needs to be born in each of us. And God can be born in the peak moments, yes, the aha moments. But more often, I think that God is born in the innocence of our day-to-day tasks, our lives, and most particularly in the places where we feel really stuck. That's where God is really longing to be born, and that's the reason why we're stuck, is that God wants to express in that stuckness. In our stuckness, in our challenges, there we get to labor to acknowledge the fear, but to also give birth to love in the midst of fear, and that's when it's really powerful. When we can give love, birth to love in the midst of fear. And so moving forward in this practice of giving love, giving birth to love in the midst of fear, we can ask ourselves in this moment, if we consider a situation in our lives that might be challenging or problematic, we can ask ourselves, will I send out an arrow of fear and create a reality around that? Or will I send out an arrow of love and create a reality around that? I think it's safe to say that when we choose love, we cooperate with this greater good, with this urge in creation that is always seeking wholeness, the Christ consciousness, which is another name for wholeness, that thing that wants to be born in each of us, in all of the duties, in all of the details, in all of the conditions of our lives. And certainly it could be love for ourselves, it could be gentleness, it could be patience, it could be acts of kindness for others, it could be acknowledging, simply acknowledging that love is sometimes hidden, but that love always wants to be born. Love is always seeking expression. Love wants to love. That's all it wants. Clearly, love wants to love in our spiritual community. In the month of December, our center offered over 740 pounds of food to families dealing with hunger. We made around 20 blankets, thanks to Lita and Gail, I believe, for those struggling with cold. We shared 60-plus holiday gifts with the families of Step Up Ventura. We just found out that a little child who wanted to volunteer, not able to volunteer at Step Up Ventura right now, but she's gonna come and help and pack up the gifts and deliver them. That's a ripple to somebody beyond the community. 60 holiday gifts to families, Step Up Ventura, people that are struggling, children that are struggling, that are impacted by homelessness. A couple of congregants just went out on the street on Wednesday and handed out 20 scarves to people on the streets of Ventura, offered them with no strings attached, no messages to come join our church, just here's a scarf for you. We love you. Keep it or give it away. We did all of this during a global pandemic. Love is alive. And these things we shall do and more. Because I just identified lots of visible acts of love coming from this community, but many of our arrows that we send are invisible. The thousands of prayers that have been offered in this building, they make a difference. The people who labor behind the scenes to make our community possible, they make a difference. The fact that the world is a better place because you and we exist, you make a difference. We make a difference. Seeing all of this and knowing all of this and participating in all of this in whatever way we can is also an arrow of love. I know, in the heat of the moment, when the world seems troubled, some of us may ask, is it enough? Is what we do here enough? Is what I'm doing in my life enough? Is giving out a scarf enough? Is buying a Christmas present for somebody at Step Up Ventura, is that enough? Will these tiny acts make a difference when there is so much pain in the world? And to that, I would say, what we accomplish here is something. Small acts or something. And in the mind of the mystic, in the mind of love, there is no size, there is no large or small. In the mind of the mystic, something and everything are one. Let's meditate on that and let us pray. Thank you. Thank you.